Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 120 featuring Tom Main. And I have to say, I have had some amazing people on this podcast. Several great, great people. Tom is up there in terms of that and really, really important. There's many of you who may not actually know who Tom is, and that's understandable. So I will explain a little bit more. Tom founded a company called Morphosis, which is an architecture company. Tom is a very, very famous architect. To put it in perspective, he won the Pritzker Prize in 2005. And for those of you who don't know what the Pritzker Prize is, it's often equated as the Nobel Prize of Architecture. A lot of very, very famous people have won the Pritzker Prize, including Zaha Hadid and Renzo Piano, Norman Foster, people like that. Really just a really great and amazing person. And, you know, he's also a teacher. He's a teacher at UCLA. He's a school of architecture. He's tenured over there. He helped found SciArch, which is the Southern California Institute of Architecture, which is another very, very well-renowned school. And as he is asked to lecture at many, many universities around the country, he's been a visiting lecturer over at Columbia, at Harvard, at Yale. He was a visiting lecturer at my old university, Rice University, at some point. And he's given TED Talks on the subject. He has a TED Talk that was recorded in 2005. And he's just very, very important. And so to sort of understand how it functions in terms of what we talk about on the podcast, it's sort of a, and you'll hear it when we talk about it a little bit, it's sort of a chicken and the egg thing that's sort of happening in the early 90s when what was happening on computers was suddenly enabling a different type of form exploration in terms of architecture that was harder to accomplish before computers were around. The way that Lon puts it, it's hard to sculpt a perfect sphere in architecture, but super easy to do it in the computer. So that exploration of that type of space becomes more, starts to define the form of the architecture. And companies like Morphosis and what Tom was doing were embracing that and started to look at a lot of sculptural forms. And I sort of really sort of embrace what he did. I mean, he's a very, very important person. And honestly, during my early years in architecture school, work like the work of Morphosis had a heavy, heavy influence on my inspiration for design. So skipping ahead 25 plus years, suddenly being able to be sitting down with Tom Main and talking to him was really quite an honor. Lon was also here with me, and he also was pretty honored. And it amazingly found out that their office is just a couple of blocks from ours, so we were able to just sort of hang out over here and do the podcast. So Tom is an incredible person, and I am really, really honored to have him on. And I hope that everyone will appreciate that my podcast. But let's do a couple of announcements before I gush too much more. I will be at FMX. Probably by the time this podcast goes up, I will be on the plane to FMX. So make sure and see that if you're going to be at FMX, let me know. It is obviously, for those of you who don't know, it's FMX is the big computer graphics conference that happens over in Stuttgart, Germany, and it's really great, and I'm very excited to be going there again this year, and I will be doing a live podcast while I'm there. Not actually a live podcast, but actually recording it in front of a live audience, and then we'll broadcast it later. And I will also be hosting some talks while I'm over there, so make sure and check those out. If you want to know everything that we're doing over at FMX, you can go to chaosgroup.com/FMX2017 and you can check out all of the schedule of things that's happening there. And you can also go to fmx.de to see the rest of the schedule of FMX. There's lots of great stuff. Vlado is going to be talking over there, as well as several other great speakers we have for our VRA days. So go check that out. Also want to remind you that if you are new to the podcast and stuff, you may want to definitely check us out on our website is labs.chaosgroup.com. You can also go to our Facebook page, which would for the podcast itself, which is facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast, all one word, CG Garage Podcast. And go ahead and like us and follow us on there. We'll give you lots of news and updates. And of course, you can always leave comments or suggestions on that page. I would love to hear from you. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter, which is @CG_labs or @CG_labs on Twitter. And you can also just follow Chaos Group if you're interested in that. So that's @ChaosGroup on Twitter. And that's it. All right, guys. Hopefully you will enjoy this amazing, amazing podcast I did with Tom Aine as much as I did. All right. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has for now.
This is amazing. I'm so glad you're able to come. It's been really, really cool. Lon and I, obviously, as you know, we're both ex-architects, and we've been doing a lot of different things. However, my audience is not all architects. In fact, most of them will probably not even know who you are, and I want to sort of put that in context, and that you would be a perfect person to describe that. But architecture, how would you describe, if you were to, someone were to come up to you and would say, how has architecture changed in the last 30, 40 years? What are some of the things you've noticed that have changed in terms of that process? What would be a good answer there?
Well, I'm talking to two architects here.
Yeah.
And so the conversation would have to start with a sea change in architecture at the beginning of the 20th century.
Right.
And the change, of course, was enormous within all of the arts. And it was connected to a shift of thinking that began in the end of the 19th century, and we're going to lead us to Darwin and Freud and Nietzsche, et cetera, which represented a monumental sea change having to do with seeing the world within dynamic terms versus static, and on and on,
mm-hmm.
right? And the complete restructuring of who we are in biological terms and in chemical and physical terms, et cetera, right? And in psychological terms, the invention of who we were, right? With these characters and the explosion of the philosophical thinking that came out of that. And it immediately took place within painting and sculpture and architecture and dance and music, et cetera. So whether it's a Stravinsky, no matter where you want to go, it's going to be this huge shift, right? And so that when we discuss now the last 30 years, let's say, you want to pick a date, 80, 90?
Sure, 80.
It's going to be absolutely a response to the shifts that took place in architecture, which were challenging all of the classical notions that had existed for the last 500 years, and then you could even claim 2,000 years
right
in front of that. The shift of thinking, which was moving into from figuration to abstraction, and was using technology as a major kind of form giving. It was political. It was part, again, the changes taking place in the beginning of the 20th century,
right,
having to do with its formation as a political force, as understanding architecture is servicing mm-hmm. broad political objectives, social, economic objectives, et cetera. And so when we, again, I'll use myself in terms of a generation.
Right.
So I show up and I'm in school in the 60s and I'm doing my thinking and kind of research in the 70s and I'm starting to work in the 80s. It's impossible not to in some way respond to these conditions that were set forth.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that it was impossible not to be influenced by the major figures. And it would be Corbusier and it would be Mies van der Rohe, and it'd be Aalto, and it'd be Louis Kahn,
mm-hmm.
right? Would be maybe the four kind of major figures that were part of my life. And even as we were challenging that and looking for a new way,
mm-hmm.
it was impossible not to to deal with the agenda that was set forth by this group of people in very different ways. Leap forward. There was a, especially in this country, there was a brief shift into a, some sort of, you might say an insurgency, a response to the modern project, which was the postmodern work.
Yes.
And in, more in this country than the rest of the world, it took on, it looked at figuration and a very kind of literal historical repetition as a response to the abstraction. And it was hard not to connect it. It would be 1980. It'd be the Reagan, the beginning of a very different political movement in this country.
Yeah.
And that it was absolutely part of a conservative kind of understanding and hugely nostalgic and looking for some past utopia or some past condition that represented a positive.
But almost classical architecture.
That's right. And but that was just a little blip. That was maybe a decade.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It wasn't even, all of us didn't buy it.
But what's interesting about that motion is that, like, you know, if you look at like Philip Johnson, right, he was like, in some cases, he was more minimalist than Mies. And then all of a sudden, he went completely postmodern.
But that itself would be an hour conversation. But because there's kind of issues now of kind of ambition and looking at kind of very easy solutions that you're not at all connected to.
Right.
With that came an agenda, and you just can't do various styles. It's impossible to separate architecture from some grounding.
Right.
That has to do with value. That's value laden.
Right. Yes.
But I'm not even close to answering your question still, I realize. So there was definitely a resurgence of the modern project, let's say, focusing on investigation, research, innovation.
Okay.
That clearly you could say one of the essences of the modern project was an idea of innovation as being central to the project.
Okay.
And that came back, and it was probably, again, in my opinion, it would be maybe most influenced by the shift of strategy in terms of how we produce the work from the simpler notions of drawing. I mean, I went to school, I used a T-square and a parallel bar and with a pencil, and you made simple drawings that were plan section elevations and et cetera, et cetera. And in 92 or 3, the beginning of the 90s, we were starting to work on with the digital, in the digital world.
Right.
And absolutely that was a sea change. And that it allowed you to develop in a way both organizationally and in terms of the formal language and an enormously more complex kind of possibilities, all right? And then that somehow would definitely link with innovation, and then in itself, it made you rethink the whole notion of the procedures by which you make architecture.
Okay.
And we worked in a very different way, and then right with that came model making, automated model making processes, et cetera. Right. And it became possible to work within a much tighter time framework, with much more, working with much more complex kind of projects, and developing, kind of opening up whole new possibilities of the concretization of ideas in the physical form that it takes, and the organizational relationship of things. And I'm not sure who will understand that. I'm interested in architecture is the formation of complex forces that are sometimes in a line and sometimes unaligned and conflictual. And it has to do with the huge numbers of inputs that produce this thing. And I've always been interested in the relationships of things and not the thing itself. And so the computer was a perfect tool that we were making the form language we were using had to do with multiple kind of organizations that were interacting, mm-hmm. and they were combinatory in nature. And the tool was absolutely perfect for that because it could deal with those types of geometries were just absolutely simple within a digital world, which were incredibly complicated, or in fact, weren't even allowable within the drawing techniques of the classical method. Yeah. So we're producing things now that we couldn't even think of.
Right.
Yeah. They were not possible out of those processes. And that definitely represents a kind of a next change in terms of your question of what's happened in the last 30 years.
So I'm going to go with a chicken and the egg scenario here. So what seeded what? Was it the technology that opened up the mind to allow you to break the political barriers that you saw that you needed to make a shift? Or did you need a shift and then suddenly this tool arrived and it's like, that's what I'm going to use to do it?
Yes.
The tool arrives at just an appropriate time.
Yeah. Right.
As architecture is seen within more complex terms, the tool becomes clearly useful.
Right.
And again, it'd be interesting looking at how various architects have used it.
Because I think you were one of the most innovative people that I've ever seen to actually embrace it for technology. Mm-hmm. For technology.
For form building.
For form building.
Yeah. But it's funny. I was never kind of a digital fan. Mm-hmm. It's just a tool.
Yeah. Right.
And I remember in the very beginning, we got some of the kind of the groupies, there were very kind of energetic characters that came out of school and in the 80s, they were computer people.
Right.
And they saw it as a, within incredibly idealistic terms, in terms of my thinking. And I just saw it as a tool, and it's a skill saw or a drill, you just pick up a tool that's useful.
Right.
But it became evident that it was from the very get-go that it was useful in terms of the types of ideas we're promoting.
Exactly.
And the goals, the ambitions we had in terms of the potential of architecture, there was just an immediate fit.
Right.
And so that there was never a there was an obviousness from the very beginning with us.
Right. I think that was, to me, it was amazing. I think I was telling the story. I was working at Gensler many, many years ago. This is back when you were in Santa Monica. And you were the first architecture firm, because Mark Briggs, who I work with directly, and he came and was like, oh, let's go see Morphosis. They're right down the corner. I know those guys. And so we went over. And you were the first company I ever saw, an architecture company, that had a 3D printer. I think it was probably the first 3D printer I saw in production.
We might have actually been the first one. It might even be true that we were the first one to use it for architecture.
And what was even more amazing, what was great about it, is it was the plaster one, right? The one that built it out of plaster.
That's right.
It was made by Z-Corp, I think.
Yeah.
And it was great. It's like, you guys made the form on the computer. You printed it, then you took the plastic form and was like, all right, now this is stage two. Now I'm going to start sculpting that.
That's right.
And you would scratch away and reform it from that. So you hybridized everything. It was about form making in whatever tools were possible. You weren't just saying, I'm going to embrace the computer. It was about the best tool for the design.
Absolutely. But several things happened too, so that would be interesting to explore. One was it radically increased the speed of which you could think about conceptual ideas. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it became apparent very early that the way we had been working traditionally, the drawings and hand models, the speed is the laborious nature of the process. A model would take maybe 10 days with two or three people. And by the time you got to it again, and especially in the beginning, in the early conceptualizations of the projects, you're working at it, your brain is going at a huge kind of speed. Mm-hmm. And it completely changed the way we're able to, the number of options and
the
expansions with the reiterations that took place creatively. And that all of a sudden we could be starting with a particular idea, 3D model it, print it. It goes in the printer at 10 o'clock at night. I walk in the office at 8 in the morning and dust it off, and we're talking again, right? And it's been 12 hours. Mm-hmm. And we're working on it like you're discussing. We're drawing, cutting it up, having another discussion that has to do with the discourse of that has to do with the reiterative method that you mm-hmm. keep challenging. Mm-hmm. It's the pauper false solution. You produce something and it's never seen as a fixed thing. It's mm-hmm. just, it's the next thing that allows you to challenge it.
Right.
And we go through that process. But it's moving like this.
Right.
And it's huge, huge difference.
Yeah.
And you could now look at our office and you'll look at a certain project. We save them. And some of them are just
teeny.
They can be also a very small scale in the beginning because mm-hmm. we're dealing with just big, broad kind of ideas and trying to establishing the terms of the project. And you look at 12 later, and that's sometimes even more than one a day. That's
right.
a week yep. or two
right.
of work. And so the huge kind of shift in the relationship of the constructional process
yeah.
and the thinking process.
Right, and the complexity of the form that you get out of that was, I mean, just the physical nature of building something like a sphere is not easy to
Absolutely.
Build in a physical
right.
model, right?
Right?
So though the ability to, you know, to experiment with space and form and geometry, that's more complex than you can build
that's
easily.
Because in a lecture, I show a competition we were doing in, I think, mid-80s in NARA for a theater, and we started with an ellipsoid. And then we needed to work with the ellipsoid, and it's not going to be a pure ellipsoid. It becomes part of a form, and we're cutting it, and we're changing it, and we're deforming it, and we're making molds and making plaster casts. And we finally gave up. And we
yeah.
realized that the competition is six, 8 weeks, and it took us a week to make the mold, and we hadn't even started the process yet. And we finally gave up and kind of drew it, and then it also kind of limited where we could go with the project
right.
in the terms. Literally 5 years later, I'm showing a similar project, and we're working with ellipsoid again.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're distorting it, and it's happening in nanoseconds.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right, in an hour, we're looking at 15 different distortions, and then we can cut it and interact it with a Cartesian language, et cetera.
Yep. Right.
And it completely changed the options you have, right?
Yep.
And then, of course, with that, as this process progressed, by 2000, we're now integrating it within the working drawing, the constructional process of a building.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you were discussing with Corey or Carenza,
but
now it's kind of moving in seamlessly, and that became, I have to say, we talked earlier, in the very beginning, it became really obvious to me from design through construction. It was just a tool that was going to, we were discussing whether we could use it partially for design and then do details by hand drawing and all that kind of thing. We said, no, I can realize that it has scalar. And once you make a model, you want to take it all the way through the process. And it
yep.
took us a decade maybe to make that really take place.
Mm-hmm.
But with the construction, something's happening that's hugely important to architecture. They'd be connected to ideas of big data, that we're
yeah.
putting more and more information very early in the process. So the stuff you see that's coming out of the office now or literally for the last 10 years, a schematic design has a huge amount of information having to do with structural engineering and all the mechanical engineering, et cetera, that form it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, again, a completely different process where you have a huge amount of pragmatic intelligence
right.
within an early conceptual model. And that becomes important if you want to realize your ideas, because that connects vision and desire with reality and right. economic reality.
Right.
That's really important. It's,
yeah.
Because it's to really realize your ideas, especially if you're aggressive in terms of your approach to what you're trying to get out of the work,
mm-hmm.
Early on, you have to prove that it's within pragmatic reality.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that you're in alignment with your client in terms of your vision of the project, because by nature, we're going to be always the most aggressive as architects. We're
right.
we're trying to push and get as much out of the project as possible. But we have to early on have that alignment. Otherwise, it's for naught.
Do you ever see, like, for example, when a lot of times I get into situations where people use a specific kind of technology for design process or whatever, and because of the, let's just call it, limitations of that technology or whatever that technology is, people tend to design something that all looks the same or looks like it was done by that piece of software or by that thing. But you guys have never done that. You seem to just skirt around those issues. What, how does that happen?
I think we tend to use just some of the attributes of the program available. And I'm I read in your question already an answer. I'm very tentative about tools that oversynthesize.
Right.
That give you the self-similarity that you're talking about, uh-huh. that you see very apparent in schools today. Mm-hmm. And it already semi-prescribes a language.
Right.
And we're aware of that. And I think, use the tools in a more primitive way maybe, because mm-hmm. I'm more interested in the kind of first principle kind of idea of the use of it, but to keep us open for the... we want to control the project, mm-hmm. and we want to control the
rules.
You have to have control of the tool you're using to make the work. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you've lost the battle.
Right.
No, but that's actually a really interesting question, because I think as the tools become more sophisticated, in quotes, I guess, mm-hmm. As they become more and more capable of synthesizing. And in developing gestalts or totalities, there'd be no question that there would have to be a repetition, because the hand of the particular studio is becoming less and less apparent and significant,
yep.
having to do with the power of the tool.
So you brought up education for a bit, and I think it's related to what we're just discussing, because I look at my architecture education as one of the most important pieces of my education, of my growing up, of my maturing, and my understanding, especially in the creative process. And I think that architecture school is very, very different than any of the other creative educations out there. Mm. One of the things that's the most important thing that I learned is how to present your project, which you have to do on a nearly daily basis in front of an audience, mm-hmm. which is about narrative, and how to take criticism, mm-hmm. which is also in architecture school, they don't shy from hard criticism.
How to expect criticism.
How to expect criticism. And I think that architecture education is unbelievably important and should have a greater influence on the creative field in general. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the unique, because you've done some art as well, and you know a little bit of the fine arts world and the architecture world, and how those things differ, and the ability to be educated in a creative field, and how architecture has changed that.
No, that part that shaped you, I think architecture still is a really rare educational experience. Mm-hmm. In that, like you're saying, you have to externalize, in many cases, very complicated ideas, mm-hmm. which are somewhat subjective and interpretive, and you have to put them into words or find a parallel narrative, because projects can be talked about within various terms, and you're deciding what terms they are, whether they're pragmatic, artistic, environmental, urbanistic, et cetera. And then with that, the student has to internalize. To me, that's the most interesting part of the education of an architect, that I remember when I met my wife, and she was in UCLA as an MBA, and we just met, and the first time she came to a jury, she was just startled of exactly what you're talking about. That these students were standing up in front of 10 jurors that had their fangs out and going after them.
Yeah.
Right? And
it's like being put like
that
being
were
being
critiquing
the
them. And then they'd spend 50, this is the end of 15 weeks of work. And they have this, it'd be impossible not to have a huge emotional investment, et cetera, in this project. And they would go through that. And it kind of startled me, because I'd been teaching long enough where I just took it for granted.
Right.
And I had to step back, and she was going, "Tom, this is absolutely amazing." And she was, again, an MBA program, studies, regurgitates the stuff, mm-hmm. and gets a grade and done.
Right.
And it's UCLA. You look at a number and you're ranked in the class, et cetera. It's all over. And but the thing that was really clear to me, and we joked about it, It was that there was no need to internalize it.
Right.
If you had a good memory, if you're a good test taker, right, you can get through school without ever being touched by any deeper notion of that knowledge.
Right.
You memorize it and you forget it a week later.
Right.
And you learn the terms of that discipline. Mm-hmm. Right. You learn the vocabulary of that discipline. And in architecture, it's impossible. And it's why there would always be an attrition rate. It'd be like playing, being in any of the arts, maybe, mm-hmm. if you're a painter, if you're a dancer, if you're a musician, et cetera.
Yeah.
At some point, it's just not technical. You have to be involved in it. And it also takes that huge energy.
Yeah.
You couldn't possibly stay in it unless you had some true kind of connection to it.
Right.
And it makes it a really interesting education because that internalization, I think, is so important. You could, it's a bit parallel to psychoanalysis in a way. Mm-hmm. It's not purely intellectual. It can only happen as fast as you can absorb it and understand right. it at an emotional level as well as an intellectual level. And so the growth is very specific to the individual, which is also unique in architecture. Mm-hmm. That, as you know, that people mature at different rates.
Yep.
And what I've always found interesting as a teacher, you'll see a kid coming into school that's just amazingly facile as a freshman. Mm-hmm. And you'll see another one sitting next to him that doesn't seem to be at all facile and is struggling. Mm-hmm. And then catch up 5 years later, and they've reversed roles.
Right.
And the one just stayed static and is kind of the same person. And the other one is absolutely completely grown and expanded his right. capabilities. And it's, again, it just represents the this huge kind of potential that takes place
right.
when you are focused in this kind of way and that they have this continuous critique and you have a chance to yourself. Well, you were saying take criticism.
Mm-hmm.
You absolutely have to listen.
Right.
And otherwise it'd be no reason to be big in the educational environment, right?
Yeah, right.
And
right.
that you're taking criticism and you're, in many cases, it's by people that you admire already. It's
yeah.
not by just anybody. There's different people in the jury that you're going to connect or not connect to, which is also important because you're already making opinions that, okay, you've got a jury with various ideological preferences.
Right.
And,
yeah.
well, one person's going to crit you in a certain way, and you go, that's good.
Right.
Because I would expect that crit from that person because right. I'm in another direction.
Right.
Versus the person that you feel more comfortable with. And that's also kind of incredibly important that you're maturing in a really complex way,
yeah,
right.
having to do with really nuanced, complex kind of value systems of who you are as an architect.
And I think it's fascinating sometimes when you're sitting there and you've created something and you don't really know what you've created, right? Because you're a student, but you've created something that evokes an emotional response between two different jury members that have opposing views about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they start to get into a fight about it and you realize, oh, look what I made. And you realize the complexity of the design. And then that's part of the education process. You're learning about the debate or the, you know, and it's those, the fact that you have 10 people up there, right? It makes it a conversation. It's incredible.
No. And it's, and then the thing you just said about you're not sure what it is yourself,
mm-hmm.
I'm that way.
Sure.
For years, I could still say that. The things I produce, I really have nothing to say about. Everything I've said is in the thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'm going to go, it's there. I have nothing to talk about. Everything in my power has been said in the energy I put in this thing, having to do with the various circumstances and forces that formed it.
Mm-hmm.
And but in the world we live in, both academically and in the outside world, I've learned that I have to have narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it's a demand that I've responded to. But personally, I have absolutely no interest in it whatsoever. I would just show the work and say, in fact, you said something earlier, you'd ask an architect what he's about.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be the last thing I'd do.
Right.
I'd never ask a director. I'd ask somebody else.
Right.
Depends what mood I'm in. In terms of what I say, who I am or what I am or what I'm trying to do.
Right.
You got to catch me on a certain day. And sometimes it's going to be quite radical than another time, just based on where my head is.
Right.
And my whole kind of thinking about, I mean, I'm filled with insecurities of the things I don't know and the struggles I'm having. And if you're going to touch a person in the middle of that struggle, I'm going to go, you know, I have no idea. I'm stuck and I'm really searching for something and I'm lost. And another time I've just come off of something and I just high as a kite and I go, man, I just nailed this one. And but again, there's a huge kind of an emotional kind of aspect to any kind of art form. And because of that, you need critics to, in many cases, I'll take notes sometimes, listen to people, and if they're talking about my work, I take notes going, God, they're absolutely right. I never thought of that. And I've never been able to put it in words because I'm clearly a visual person and not a verbal person, mm-hmm. or I'm definitely much more of a visual person. And so things will be said about things I'm doing that I'll take a note and say, it's clear to me now. I get it. And I'll repeat the comment that someone else made because it's not, it's either solely obvious to me, I don't even think about it, or it's just not the way I think. Right. I think in terms of the experience and the visual, a dynamic visual kind of environment.
Well, I think it's fascinating. You know, you had mentioned insecurities that you have in your own words or finding the right words. I think that's a very common thing for architects because architects, as a profession, as a creative profession, we are creative service in a lot of ways, right? We have to go to people of varying different lifestyles and workplaces and industries and create environments that serve them. And we have to educate ourselves about that environment and that process. So we're constantly learning about things. And so we're constantly feeling like we don't know anything in a lot of ways. So I think that insecurity is very common in the architect as opposed to, I know exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to paint that painting and it's in my head and it's done and no one else has any say to say about it.
It's actually one of the fascinating things about the profession. I just turned 73. It's you cannot master it.
Yeah.
It's an impossibility.
Right.
And it's an impossibility of exactly what you're talking about. It's the breadth is just about infinite.
Right.
And so it's not even, at some point you recognize that and there's not even a goal to do that. It's absurd,
mm-hmm. right?
And it's gotten more so going back to even the digital environment and the increase in information and the breadth of information and in the various disciplines you're touching with that information.
Sure.
And it becomes even more kind of impossible to ever kind of completely master that situation. And another thing you said that strikes me that's kind of unique to the profession and definitely starts with young students. You have to move left, right at the speed of light.
Okay.
Because you're in your own, you're in your brain and you're working within conceptual, interpretive, subjective terms. And then a nanosecond later, you're on a job site with a construction crew.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is maybe finally the most unique thing about being an architect, that there's not a lot of people that either enjoy or have the capability of left-right. They're right or left.
Yeah.
Right?
Strategy
and not only left-right, but moving in instantaneous time frame, moving
right.
back and forth. And you'd have to kind of enjoy. I actually have to enjoy it and for whatever reason.
Right.
And I find it really challenging and enjoyable moving constantly from the pragmatic world back into your own private world
mm-hmm.
and leaping back and forth. And it's but it'd be, I would think, the most unique thing of actually the profession, that it's hard to name any profession that has to do that. You're more in one world or the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are your thoughts, Lon?
Well, I love the idea that it's true. The more you know about something, the less you feel you know, right? Like you're not going to master it. But I think that's one of the things that always drew me to architecture in the first place was this ability to think on a holistic scale and then to get to narrow down into the details, right? Because even if you think about the best business leaders, in fact, I was listening recently to the story of Nike. And they were talking about how the guys who had started Nike, that was their kind of skill set. They were able to go, here's the big picture, and now here's how we're going to tackle the factory and the nuances of everything. And because they had more than one of those guys, it was one of the reasons they were successful. And I think that I think that's one of the powerful parts of an architectural education or being involved in that mindset. Even there was something else too that was interesting. Is you have to build as you mature, as you go through those conversations. There's an emotional intelligence that you build, right? Because you start to read people's reactions, or you start to understand and expect certain responses, and so mm-hmm. on. And you craft your story, you tell it differently depending on the circumstance. So it's never just one narrative, right? It's always
absolutely.
It's always multifaceted throughout, and that's something that's kind of unique as well. One of the things that strikes me still to this day is that I read that architecture students are still the ones with the lights on all night. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of reminds you that, like, well, regardless of technology and efficiencies and everything else, there's still a lot of work to do and a lot of stuff mm-hmm. to be learned. And so I wonder if that will ever change too. Like, you know, are architecture students just always going to be
the— I think it's because our brains can't turn off.
The all-nighters.
Our brains can't turn mm-hmm. off. And so even if we can go through a million iterations, we're still just going to keep thinking.
You're going to go through 2 million if you can do it.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of various art forms, it takes a certain amount of concentration to warm up.
Yeah.
And so it's not an 8-to-5 thing, much less a 2 or 3 hour thing. And you can leave it and come back again. There's many instances that we've all gone through over a lifetime where at 9 o'clock at night, you're just warmed up and certain things are starting to take place. And the end has more to do with the task at hand, mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. conceptual, the thinking at hand, than it does with any notion of time. And so it's, time is just, it's completely relevant to the nature of that moment, et cetera. And so if it's 1 in the morning or 4 in the morning, it's whatever it takes you to arrive somewhere.
Right.
All right. And it's the arriving that finally is the determinant, right? Mm-hmm. That says what it's going to be, right? That certainly defines that. You can always, in any school, you know where architecture, if you're looking for the architecture building,
yeah,
and it's 9 o'clock, just look for the lights.
Lights are on.
you'll find it for sure.
Yeah, the amount of time that we spent, I remember, so I was going through this, my thesis, right, because I was trying to analyze everything. My previous education, my undergraduate education is mathematics, so I analyzed everything, right? And so I figured out that the period of time where I need to be the most productive was at the end of my day, and it was the time where I was the least productive, which was between the hours of 6 and midnight or something like that, right? So I decided I'm going to shift my entire day and I'm going to go to sleep between 6 and midnight. And I would come to architecture school at 1 o'clock in the morning. And that's when everyone was exhausted and about to fall to bed. But I had been asleep, and I had the whole place to myself for the early, early morning hours. And my brain was fresh then. I guess it's just the way my brain was working. And then by the end of the day, unfortunately, what happened is I was still taking classes. So my brain was dead
for classes.
But at least for the design process, I was ready to go. And that was I think that was something. But, basically, I was in architecture school 18 hours a day, you know, at my desk working, only sleeping about 6, you know? So
that's interesting. It's something, more students should figure that one out. Funny, when I was in grad school, I was up at 5 in the morning and took a run and got to school at 6 or 7.
Right.
Had a quick breakfast and worked till 1 or 2 when studio started. Tried to get the first crit.
Right.
And I was out of the studio at 3.
Right.
And then read, went to the gym, had dinner that night, went to lectures at various parts of the campus, didn't even go back to the studio.
Right.
And it was people were just arriving at class, and I was done.
Right.
But I realized that I was most productive in the morning.
Yeah, that was your time.
And it was my time. And it was really weird. It was a class that I was complete freak. That everybody does, they're all in the same program.
Right.
They're early in the morning. And then I would come back once in a while at night after a lecture or something, and they'd be dropped. They're working like like they're moving their hand, they're barely moving it, and they're slumped over their desk. And I realized that, hey guys, you need some sleep.
Right.
In fact, it's funny because when we have a conversation in our office, the studio, all the time, that we have to deprogram people from that notion. And I'm going, no, first thing you have to learn is what does it take for you to work or to just think or be a human being in a productive way?
Mm-hmm.
Right. All right. And you've got to get out of this habit of doing the 5 or 6 hours a night because you're not a person that can do that. Some can, right. But most people aren't. And figure it out. It's 7 or 8. Figure out your minimum as you're coming here. Unlike school, we're actually responsible for producing a product at a certain level, and we take complete responsibility for that. And right. I need you alive and awake. And there's a problem in this thing you're talking about,
sure.
too. It's just it's become what is it? It's just some sort of a cultural
right
kind of an idea that that's what you have to do.
And you have other responsibilities in a work environment too, like. I need you to be lucid for the conversation.
Absolutely. Funny is in a studio for years now. I have them turn the project in a day or two early.
Yeah,
and because we joke with them, they show up in the jury and the whole class. They've been up
just
for 3 nights.
Out.
They can't remember a thing. I go, hey guys, this is the reason you're here.
Right.
And of all the time you want to be awake, and we're inviting a few people in, and they're going to be people that have something interesting to say, most likely, and you want to be lucid.
Yeah,
right.
Organize your thoughts.
We did that at Rice too. We had we had charrette, right? So they would like literally run around and ring a bell, and everyone had to be done at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon on whatever. And everyone had been up for a week.
Yeah.
And so everyone just ran out after a charrette was done, and they were ready, and they ran out of the architecture school, and the graduate student bar was across the street, which was the worst idea.
Yeah.
And they would grab, because it was a nonprofit graduate student bar, so it was like a 50-cent beer, and they'd have one beer, and they'd asleep on the lawn. And
of course.
It was like, but yeah, it was tough. It was really tough. But I think, you know what, at the same time, like I said, it was an amazing education. And I think it really should, people should be more aware of what that education is, because people in architecture school are like, oh yeah, it's amazing. It's incredible. But not many people know. I mean, people know about law school, they know about medical school, but they don't know about architecture school, right? Hmm. And I think it's an important thing that people should be aware of.
Well, and of course, I don't know who your audience is, if it's LA or national, but
international.
We're in a city that has some of the best educational environments in the world.
Right.
Between SIARC and UCLA and USC, plus another whole series of schools. It's an incredible environment.
Yeah.
And the work coming out of these schools and the number of lectures, et cetera, it's just there's nothing stronger in the world, I don't think.
No, it's really
than
really
LA
good.
Over the last really 20 or 30 years, it's been a really, really powerful place.
Yeah.
If you're studying architecture.
Well, I think it's an important thing. And obviously I know that, you know, a lot of that boom happened in that era that we talked about at the beginning of the podcast. I kind of trying to wrap it up because I know you need to go and we're going to, but that boom that happened in the 80s and what happened in LA during that time, I think was incredibly important. And you were a very big, important part of it, obviously. But there was that shift that happened. I think you said there was similar to what happened in the turn of the century, in the turn of the 20th century, there was a shift that happened where something had to be different. We had to move away from postmodernism or whatever. That was like, that's the end. We have to break that mold politically, technologically,
artistically.
Right. Do you feel that we're close to another period of that nature, or do you think there's a natural evolution that's going
to
happen?
Oh, dear. We seem to be at the opposite end of the spectrum, actually.
Right.
There certainly isn't an alignment between the possibilities in architecture today and the world as it operates pragmatically, economically. And there seems to be, it seems to be increasingly difficult to produce work that has the kind of innovation that's mm-hmm. possible today, especially in this country. And although history's proven that there's no necessity of alignments between a situation within political and cultural terms and the artistic. There is an architecture in the arts. It's the most connected in terms of patronages and the necessity for clients that are in some way supportive of the objectives of a particular era and within the architecture community. And we're in a, I guess nothing new here. I mean, we're in a kind of a very odd period of history, mm-hmm. which is for a lot of people just about unimaginable in terms of kind of where it's taken us. I would have thought in answering your question, given the beginning of a shift during, let's say, the Reagan years, moving towards a much more conservative agenda and something moving towards, in an architectural world, it'd be connected to a more literal historicism. But again, looking in the past versus the future, that we should be in that bell curve moving the other direction. Mm-hmm. And the profession is, so you can't stop that. It is what it is. And you can't contain that. The invention that happens within the discipline itself is an autonomous thinking process. But it's the construction through reality finally becomes incredibly important to the proof of these ideas. And as you know, there's a time as an architect's developing, beginning from his student years, moving to the kind of his first work in his, let's say, 30s. By 40, approaching 50, it'd be pretty difficult to develop without building.
Right.
That it can't stay at a conceptual level, that you need feedback now for your own thinking process, and it becomes incredibly important. It's why LA has been, you were discussing about the 80s, it was an incredible environment precisely because it's filled with small scale events. Yeah. Right? Versus a New York or a Chicago or a Boston. Yeah. And it's also extremely open. For possibility, for invention, for the future. And it made it just a hotbed that was connected to both ideas and the realization and the feedback loop of that work as it challenged the conceptual structure of architecture. And it made LA just an amazing place in the 80s. And it still is, given various places in the States, is still fairly strong at that level. But it seems really difficult right now that we're in just this odd period where there seems to be a questioning of any, somehow innovations connected to risk somehow. Mm-hmm. But there's a questioning about innovation. There was an article yesterday in New York Times at their National Science Institute. They're looking at defunding it, and they're not hiring any scientists. I'm going, this is not possible. We have an economy that's based on a service industry of intellectual creative capital.
Right.
And they're talking about coal miners. And I go, wait a minute, it's not even the 20th century. We're talking about the 19th century. Mm-hmm, right. It's absolutely absurd when we should be retraining people in those types of ancient industries into contemporary replacements. And right. It's going to be wind and et cetera, right?
Right.
And that represent the technology that's not only available, but that we're going to be looking at continually rebuilding and rethinking and conceptualizing. And it's, again, we just are in a really kind of an odd place right now where there seems to be a focus on issues that just aren't going to be useful to anybody in the creative process, certainly not to architects, because it requires a constituency that is interested in the future and in innovation, et cetera, which is the basis of any creative act.
And the kind of irony that just struck me now is that we're approaching this point in architecture where almost anything is possible.
Right.
So like the ability to innovate and experiment is at an all-time high.
And yet we're not allowed to do it.
and you might be, moving backwards from a political spectrum.
Right. But when people responded to our work, a lot of times they look at it as very kind of extreme and super ambitious and kind of radical. And I kind of look at them and go, not at all. This is just this thinking with current technology and current philosophical and conceptual thoughts, it's just not at all radical. It's just literally, if you just sit somebody down and use contemporary processes, this is what you come up with, right? And not too many people would agree. Because it still is outside the framework because there's so little of it still.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's just not part of the existing currency. And wow, what a shame.
I think that's really the goal that, you know, when I'm trying to introduce, you know, someone like you to the audience I have is for people to realize, like, you know, you thought that was different. Think, you know, really look at this, and this is, you don't have to think in these quote unquote traditional ways. And I think that's really nice to be able to think differently and to think, or like you said, it to you, it's completely natural, but to a lot of people, I think it would be harder for them to make that shift. And I think it's nice to be able to understand that process.
But that's going to have to change. That there's going to be, well, first place, it's a really complicated political condition in this country, and it's more or less 50-50.
Right.
Right. And it just leans slightly one way or the other, and it's a couple percent.
Yep.
And it's also a very complicated structural condition where the rural part of this country is overrepresented in both Congress and in Senate.
Right.
And versus cities. And yet the GDP is absolutely within, I don't know, it's like 80% is within urban.
Right.
And there's some very basic constructs that are out of the line right now.
Right.
That have to realign.
Sure.
And just in the most pragmatic terms, just right. in economic, political, social, cultural terms, right? And which will have to happen. But finally, I don't want to end up in a negative. finally, architecture, when we go to work, I leave behind my morning reading of the New York Times and whatever I think is the catastrophe going on next in this country at the moment. And when I walk in the door, I'm sitting down and working on a particular project having to do with its possibilities given all of the kind of opportunities we have today.
Right.
Right. And I leave that beside. I'm go to work. And at that level, and it would start with your education of an architect, your conversation, right. that we are used to working within our own autonomous kind of territory and can put the world aside. And it has its own, our discipline has its own power and its own kind of issues that drive us,
right.
that are outside of the day-to-day world.
I mean,
and then the second one is then you step back into the data where, well, now it's your left-right conversation, and now you have to define the narrative by which you're going to produce the work. Right. And the narrative now does have to be somehow connected to the reality,
right.
which is a very different reality than the one that produced the work, right. which is much more autonomous within its own terms. Make sense?
Yeah.
And so, that's, again, a kind of it takes a person with a certain ego strength, and you are comfortable that working within, you define the terms of your own life. It was a Candide, Voltaire. Happiness doesn't exist. You make the condition define your own happiness.
Yes.
And you produce it. And I think if I remember right, it even talked about making and doing something is the most powerful kind of notion.
Yeah.
And you create your own, you recreate your own reality to start with. And architecture is a discipline that absolutely, that's the kind of the essence of the, right? If you're going to be satisfied, if you're going to be comfortable within it, that it has to do with the fact that you do have some control over your own life.
Well, that's a wonderful way to end the podcast. I really appreciate it, Tom. It was a great, great conversation.
Good.
I'm sure people will eat it up. I know I was glad you could do it. But as you know, I'll be stopping by your office more often to talk to Carenza and Corey because I already could tell that we're going to get along famously.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So we're going to be they're going to stop by here sometime. Next week, and we're going to see doing some great stuff.
Oh, so, it's great to have you guys as neighbors.
Yeah, I know. It's good. Really cool.
Okay.
All right, thanks so much.